Healing Systems, Urbana Acupuncture, and Amara Yoga.
It's 12:37. An upper-level disturbance dropping southeast this afternoon will bring scattered showers to parts of the upper Midwest and Great Lakes. The system could drop far enough south to bring some showers to parts of eastern Illinois and Indiana on Wednesday. Otherwise, dry weather with seasonable temperatures can be expected for much of the remainder of the week. In fact, high temperatures today will range from the lower 50s across northern Wisconsin to near 80 degrees across the Missouri Boot Heel. Low temperatures tonight will range from the upper 30s in northern Wisconsin to the mid-50s across western Kentucky. Here in Champaign-Urbana today, mostly sunny skies with a high around 75, winds out of the northwest 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy and cool with a low around 48. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, the high around 68. And Wednesday night, mostly clear, the low 42. Thursday, sunshine, the high near 70. Mostly clear, sunny skies the rest of the week. Highs in the low to mid-70s, lows in the upper 40s to low 50s. Should see some clouds returning this weekend, but as of this moment, it appears we may not receive any more significant rain the rest of the week. Fingers crossed. Checking temperatures around the region at this hour. In Danville, it's 70 degrees. Clear skies, 69 in Decatur. In Jacksonville, clear skies, 71 degrees. In Lincoln, it's clear and 71. In Bloomington, clear skies, 67 degrees. At Willard Airport, some scattered clouds, 69 degrees right now. Winds out of the west at 15 miles per hour. Some gusts up to 22. Relative humidity, 51%. The barometric pressure is 29.93 inches and holding steady. And outside our studios on Friends Plaza in Urbana, it's 69 degrees. You're listening to The Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen. The 1997 documentary Hands on a Hard Body followed the contestants in a Texas car dealership competition. Hopefuls had to keep one hand on a new fully loaded truck, and the last person standing kept it. As NPR's Nita Ulaby reports, that surprisingly dramatic story is now being made into a musical.
It's called Hands on a Hard Body. The hard body is the truck. At a rehearsal at the La Jolla Playhouse in California, it's on casters so the actors can spin it around the stage.
We're going clockwise 180 to 730.
Tony Award-winning director Neil Pepe is more accustomed to interpreting the dramas of David Mamet or Harold Pinter.
It's such an odd challenge as a director to have this, you know, truck sitting in the middle of a stage.
Check out the musical's creators. The composer is Trey Anastasio of the band Fish. Benjamin Millepied is the choreographer. He is the former New York City ballet star who also choreographed the movie Black Swan. The script's by Doug Wright, who won a Pulitzer for his play I Am My Own Wife a few years ago.
When I first started to talk about the musical to friends and colleagues, they said, that's an inherently flawed idea. It's a bunch of people standing still for hours on end.
And they'll stand there as long as they can. And the last one remaining wins that beautiful truck.
The documentary, Hands on a Hard Body, focuses on people desperate for a truck or for money.
So that's the first thing I do is sell the truck. I have so many bills to pay off. I have a car. I want to go back to school.
Kelly Mangrum in the documentary has a different story in the musical. She starts a romance with a young guy whose hands are on the truck right next to her. They fantasize about winning the truck and getting out of Texas together.
All the musical ideas in the story came from the characters themselves.
Trey Anastasio of the band Fish tuned into a southern symphony of country, rock, blues, and gospel to compose the musical. One contestant in the documentary listens to religious music to keep going and lapses into states of ecstasy.
She starts laughing.
Anastasio made the scene a musical number.
What you gonna do next? Start handling snakes or speaking in tongues?
At this point in the contest, bodies are numb and the contestants are sleepless, disoriented, and vulnerable. Norma Valverde's sense of divine connection is, if briefly, catching. In this song, the truck itself becomes an instrument. Playwright Doug Wright and his collaborator Amanda Green hired a private detective to find the original contestants, including that woman so transported by religion.
Norma Valverde is living in the Houston area now. Her kids are all proudly off to college, which is a first for her family.
Wright and Green asked for permission from every real person they turned into a character, and they offered them a financial stake in the show, if it makes any money.
Because when you're writing a piece that deals with certain issues of economic exploitation, the last thing you want to do is be accused of it.
For Wright, making this contest into a musical was a way to bring lower-income American voices in front of affluent theater audiences.
I can't do it. I got pins in this knee.
The contestants in the documentary are woefully unprepared for the grueling effort of standing for days.
Russell's out here in boots. What? You can't do this thing in boots.
The contest's intense physical demands resonated for choreographer Benjamin Millepied. He insists it was not a challenge to create dances for people just standing around a truck. He says he was struck by the contestants' trance-like swaying in the documentary as the contest dragged on and on.
Moving, keeping some type of movement as you get the exhaustion to, you know, keep you awake and to also keep your blood moving and moving from one feet to the other.
One contestant in the movie and musical who seems likely to win is a young Marine. In this version, he's traumatized by his experience in combat.
Yet I kept on growing stronger than I was the day before. Stronger, like you have to be in war. I know what the future holds in store.
The contest exposes contestants' strengths and frailties as they cling to a shiny symbol of power and mobility. It's summed up in the documentary by a man named Benny Perkins.
You know, it's a human drama thing, and it's more than just a contest, and it's more than just winning the truck.
Maybe Hands on a Hard Body is not so different from a musical, say, about a chorus line. It's about the same things: competition, hard work, tenacity. Neda Ulibi, NPR News.
A lot of folks are talking about next week's initial public stock offering from Facebook, but you won't hear anything from anyone who works at the giant social networking company. That's because of longstanding SEC rules that prevent companies from hyping their stock prior to an offering. NPR's Ben Bergman has this report.
Once a company files the paperwork to go public, it's not allowed to say anything that could be construed as hyping its stock. It must remain quiet. Everything investors need to know about a company is supposed to be in a single document, says Don Keller, a lawyer who represents companies going public.
The idea behind the rules is that the SEC wants you to use the prospectus as the vehicle to convey information to the public in a controlled, disciplined way.
Sounds pretty straightforward, right? Well, it's not. Just ask Google, which almost had its IPO delayed for an interview its founders gave to Playboy, or Salesforce.com, which had its offering pushed back because its CEO talked to the New York Times. And then there's Groupon. Here's how CEO Andrew Mason described his tortured IPO experience to 60 Minutes.
We've now been hazed, you know. We're like Wolverine, and our skin has been melted off, and we've had adamantium fused under our bones.
Mason ran afoul of the SEC for, among other things, writing a memo that ended up being leaked. He said he was merely defending his company against a chorus of negative analysts and reporters who, of course, weren't muzzled by a quiet period.
I'm not going to pretend like it's been fun to sit here and have something that we've poured our hearts into over the last 3 years and see it criticized while we have our mouths taped shut.
By all accounts, the Facebook IPO has gone much more smoothly. Still, there are many who share Mason's disdain for the quiet period. Rakesh Agrawal, an analyst at Redesign Mobile, is among them.
It's a bit of an anachronism. It goes back to a time when companies had all the power in terms of getting messages out to potential investors.
That time is long gone. The rules that govern what companies can say have remained pretty much the same since quiet periods were introduced in 1933. The SEC did clarify the rules back in 2005, saying companies can still advertise during quiet periods and that they're allowed to continue communications that are a regular part of their business. But to Agrawal, that's not the same as leveling the playing field. He says we live in an era when a single tweet can undermine a company's IPO.
Now with internet and social media, you just have the ability to communicate with lots of players, including bloggers and analysts and people like myself who are commenting on these companies, and it seems only right that companies should be able to respond to that.
Aaron Alter is a lawyer who's advised dozens of high-tech companies going through IPOs. His advice is always the same. Be very careful what you say.
The consequences are high and the benefits are relatively low when it comes to not being very careful during the quiet period.
Alter says he's seen the SEC's enforcement of the quiet period only get stricter. Though he concedes the rules aren't perfect, he says they remain very important.
You're protecting investors. You are not allowing companies to be out there touting their stock, inducing the public to buy the stock without the benefit of seeing the financials and the risk factors and the discussion of the management team and all those things that any reasonable investor would want to know.
And one final note, we tried to interview the SEC for this story, but even though they are allowed to talk whenever, wherever they want, they preferred to stay quiet. Ben Bergman, NPR News.
This fall, visit England and Wales, locations made famous in Last of the Summer Wine, Downton Abbey, and more, including Agatha Christie's home on the coast of South Devon. Does American history suit you? Well, travel in private vintage train cars on our Civil War train. This September's itinerary includes important southern battlefields and discussions with historian Anthony Pitch. Information is at will.illinois.edu/willtravel or call 217-333-7300.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 8th of May, 2012. It's the birthday of Edmund Wilson, born Red Bank, New Jersey, 1895, one of the most influential critics of the 20th century. His essays on Dickens and Kipling and Flaubert changed public perception of their work. He was very frank as a critic. Did not care for the Carl Sandburg biographies of Lincoln. He said, "The cruelest thing that has happened to Lincoln since being shot by Booth was to have fallen into the hands of Carl Sandburg." And he once described Tolkien's Lord of the Rings as juvenile trash. It's the birthday of the poet Gary Snyder, born San Francisco, 1930, associated with the Beat Generation. He read at the famous Six Gallery reading in 1955 when Allen Ginsberg read Howl for the first time. Most of the Beats were city kids, and they were fascinated by Gary Snyder because he grew up in the woods of Washington and Oregon, and he knew the names of things, and he'd worked as a logger and a fire lookout. And he was a dedicated Zen Buddhist. Gary Snyder, who's lived in the same house since 1970, a house built by hand on a 100-acre plot of land in the Sierra Nevada. Snyder said, "We built it with a crew of boys and girls who were almost all in their first year out of college, without any construction experience of any kind, all with hand tools and no electricity. Everyone was working, cleaning, cooking, and learning equally." The subtext is that the 60s sometimes worked. It's the birthday of the novelist Thomas Pynchon, born Glen Cove on Long Island, 1937, one of the most elusive and gifted writers of the 20th century. Very few photographs of him in circulation. He went to Cornell, where it is rumored he studied with Nabokov, but couldn't understand what he was saying. The author of numerous novels, including V, Gravity's Rainbow, and Against the Day. His most recent book is Inherent Vice. His longtime friend Phyllis Gebauer donated the only known collection of signed first editions of Pynchon's work to the UCLA Extension Writers Program, and Pynchon sent a message to be read at the ceremony. He said, "I was planning to skydive into the middle of these proceedings. Thank you for your teaching." It's the birthday of the Irish novelist Roddy Doyle, born Dublin 1958, author of the Barrytown trilogy, The Commitments, The Snapper, The Van, also the first Irish novelist to win the Booker Prize for his book Paddy Clark, Ha Ha Ha. And it was on this date, 1970, the Beatles released their last album, Let It Be. They weren't happy with the mix, so Phil Spector took on the project, and the album was released a month after Paul McCartney announced he was leaving the band. In 2003, a new version was released that undid most of Phil Spector's work, a remix entitled Let It Be Naked. Here's a poem for today by Abigail Gramig, Requiem. Today is the perfect day, the sky just so, clouds moving fast, drops of water on leaves of Russian sage, dog sitting her chin on crossed paws, light streams through branches of locust tree. I sit just so at the small table. Everything is perfect, just like this. You would